chair to go in the back if you feel more secure.
You want to?
VIPs usually sit in the first seat.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. Pizza? Etter at de begynte i pizza, så det drukket de som etter et før, så kom det nesten
inn. Så var det før å huske, ja. Nei, jeg håper ikke var det en samme sånn.
Veldig rett.
Jeg liker å se hva de gjør.
This is your chair.
Yes.
It's okay.
So hi everybody online. It's very crowded today, so we wait until the last persons are seated and got their pizza and coke and everything. Somebody cross-checking that we are online? Carl, would be nice just to see. Welcome everybody to the next session of NIST lecture. Now our own fan club is coming. Welcome. It's my special pleasure to announce Andrei Shlaknikov, who was one of our former master students. So he was one of many of those like you. He joined us in September 2011, and in October 2011, he entered my office and I said, Catherine, are you one of those professors here? I would like to work in a research lab. So after 1 month, he started. And then he said, I don't really need money. I just want to do research. Can I be on? What a surprise. Very eager student. So eventually we figured out how to work together. And Andre made very clear that he burns from the topic, that he would like to learn more, and that he would like to stay in Norway. So after his master studies, that took me, like everybody of you, 2 years, he was able to join the digital forensics group as a PhD or doctoral researcher. And now, another 4 years later, Andre has submitted his PhD thesis. And today you will get a glimpse on what he has been found out over the last years. And I would say 1 hour is not much. I think Andre can stand here for 8 hours, if not more. He has gained a lot of experiences. Be invited to meet him in the lab. And if you would like to hear even more about our research and the research of our partners and the activities, you are also warmly invited for SECANOC. This is an annual information security security event that we organize here in Norway. Yes, there's pizza and yes, there is Coke. Be prepared for 26th of October. And for now, Vashigo.
Thank you for coming. Honestly, I didn't expect that the topic is so popular, but thanks for coming here. So today we'll talk about the NeuroFuzzy, the method and application in digital forensics that I've been working last 4 years. So we'll present the methodology, what it is, the application area, and also some practical artifacts that we discovered. This is basically the content of my talk. So first I will give a little bit introduction into the topic, the digital forensics, the machine learning, the NeuroFuzzy, and then some improvements. So basically key findings that we applied, and then what are the results, or why it's important to use it. And in the end, applications. So what are exactly applications? So where we apply the theory into practice. And finally, the artifacts. So this is more like practical, technical things. So how many of you are familiar with digital forensics? Okay. And how many with machine learning? Not bad. Yeah. So basically, I will start with digital forensics, but then slowly I will explain how this can be applied for digital forensics and why it's important also. So digital forensics basically is a set of methodologies used to find like evidences in crime scene. So you have the forensic science, which covers different area, and then you have the digital forensics, which is only specific to computers or devices where you have some operating capabilities, where you have some memory, storage, and so on. So in this case, the digital forensics has a lot of subfields. For example, like malware analysis, network forensics, can be social media mining, for example, and so on. So it's a lot of things. And then in the literature, you also can find so-called digital forensics process. So digital forensics process in this case can be divided into two parts. So things that are done basically in the crime scene. So this is an identification of the things of interest, then preparation, then preparing the approach strategy, and preserving these devices, for example. And another thing which is done in the lab. So this is the collection. So collection of the data from the data carriers that been seized from the crime scene. Examination of this data. Analysis. So in this work, I'm focusing more on analysis part. And then finally preparing the final report. Then we have the computational forensics. So basically the computational forensics is a set of methodologies that use computer for modeling or computer models for modeling, for analysis, and so on to help the investigators. Because the thing is that there are so much data now that it's quite hard to do it manually. So they has to be used some kind of computational approach to process these data. So it's just some of the examples. When the digital scans of the footprints being used to match each other, for example, with some like score. So what are the similarity between the footprints? And another thing, it was, I think, related to skull similarities. So if there is a skull, there is a photo, how this can be related, if it is the same person or not. And basically the machine learning. So machine learning is a set of methods that are capable of basically learning from data and producing some model. So it can be also classification, it can be simple prediction, anything virtually that you can imagine. And normally we are talking about two phases. The first one is training from the data. When you have the data, you need to train the model from this data. And another one is testing. So when the model is trained, you have some let's say application is coming, and you need to define whether it's malicious or benign. Then you push it to the model, and then you get the answer whether it's malicious or benign, or some percent that this is malicious, some confidence, for example. But in reality, it's quite complicated, because beside this general approach, you have so many methods that can be used for feature extraction, for raw characteristic processing, then for learning, for example, and so on. So it's really hard to apply it in reality. You need to know the field where you need to apply this, and you need to know the properties of these methods to be able to build the proper model, because otherwise it will fail and just end up with erroneous model. Further, if we're talking about the machine learning, you can see in the literature soft computing and hard computing. So soft computing is more applicable for real world problem. So for example, when you have the mistaken data or the data that are incomplete, so just some fields are missing, for example, and so on. And also the nice thing about the soft computing that it can basically give you the human understandable model, like for example fuzzy logic. You have the numerical features, and then you have also the fuzzy sets, which are linguistic things, for example. Then you have the hard computing, which is traditional classic logic, where you have like true and false. And those models are quite complicated, even in, I mean, especially in the case when you have the real world data with a lot of mistaken data. So it's quite hard to have the generalization in this case. So this is just the set of the methods. It's quite hard to see, but in the literature you can find the examples of the soft computing methods. A nice illustration of the difference between the hard computing and soft computing. So it's nothing wrong from this side with hard computing model, because you have the exact definition of what is happening, for example, the mass of this thing, the velocity, and so on. But it might take some time until you understand what's happening and like how this is relevant to you. So on the right side, you can see that, well, this is relevant for you, and like you can understand already that something is wrong, for example. And from the model side perspective, it's also important to see that the models for hard computing, they can be quite complicated. So it really can be just overfitted model if you feed this real world data with all the mistakes in it. In contrary, you have the basically the soft computing model on the right side, and then you have the general fuzzy rules that can be also understandable and then can be used to describe the data, to classify the data. The next thing that we need is hybrid intelligence. So hybrid intelligence is the approach when you combine couple standalone machine learning methods to achieve some generalization, for example, some better performance, accuracy, or so on. So in this case, you have different types of data, you have different types of machine learning methods, and also you can apply the optimization to achieve the goal. So just combination of several methods to achieve something good and also mitigate the weaknesses of both methods. So now we came to the neurofuzzy, which is basically the core concept in my PhD. It was proposed in the 90s by Bart Kosko, so he's a professor in the US. And then basically this is combination of the neural networks and the fuzzy logic. The original model, it consists of two stages. The first stage, when the data are processed by unsupervised neural networks, basically the self-organizing map. After this, the rules are extracted, and then finally we have this model. So these are the rules plus they are tuned. So we have two things. The first thing is the rules that describe the data, so descriptive model. And the second thing is that basically these rules are used in the classification model. So you also can classify data for future, let's say. And you also can explain why this classification decision was made based on the rules. So as I said, this is hybrid intelligence method that combined two methods, the neural networks and the fuzzy logic. So fuzzy logic, how many of you know what is fuzzy logic? Okay, so you have the classical logic, basically, which is true, false, like 0, 1. And then you have the fuzzy logic. So in this case, you take the whole interval between 0 and 1. So it can be 0, 75, true. So it's like kind of truth, confidence, let's say. So it's a little bit better if you have a lot of mistakes in the data and you need to have this an exact solution. So in this case, we are talking about the mapping the data, the numerical data, to the linguistic terms. In this case, it can be low, medium, high. So for example, if you have the temperature, then you can talk about like plus 20, this is hot for somebody. But for other people, it can be like medium or something like low, for example, temperature. So it also can be adjusted. So it's kind of the abstraction model between the numerical data and the linguistic representation of this data. So the fuzzy rules that they have two types. This is Mamdani type rule. The first one, this is classification rule. And also you have the regression rules. For example, based on the data, you need to predict some measure. So this is also can be done via fuzzy logic. And in this case, we are talking only about the classification rules. It consists of two parts. The first one is antecedents. So basically any kind of input numerical features can be used. They map to the linguistic terms or linguistic fuzzy set for each of the numerical feature. And then afterwards, you have the basically antecedent part, which refers to the classification. So for example, this is class 1 or class 2, or something like this. And then this mapping is done usually using some kind of membership function, which is depends solely on the properties of the data. So you need to have the data. You need to understand like whether it's Gaussian distribution, whether it's some kind of other distribution. So at this point, we combine the digital forensics and hybrid intelligence. So basically, why it's important to use the hybrid intelligence for digital forensics. So this is a representation that we have for large-scale data. We need to extract some kind of representation of these things that are found in the data that are relevant to the investigation. So also it's quite important to know that there are so much data that nobody does the full forensics, because if you have like hundreds of thousands of files on the hard drive and you open each file and you check it, like spending 30 seconds, just imagine how much time you need. And apparently it's not just productive, so it's irrelevant. You need to have some other approaches. Like, for example, many of the tools, they use only search. So you use the keyword, then you search, you find the relevant documents, and then like you work on these documents. And this is when the hybrid intelligence comes, that it's due to ability to handle real-world data and also ability to produce the human understandable solutions. So the fuzzy logic, what's nice about the fuzzy logic, that it represents the data using the human understandable readable formats. But the problem that you need to train, you need to tune this rule. So you need to have exact mapping between the numerical data to the linguistic terms, because in this case, if there is a mistake or something, then the model won't work just so. It's quite important to have it. In case of neural networks, you don't need to have any preliminary data. The model generates quite fast, and then also it can classify. So it can classify any kind of things. But the problem that you cannot actually make any understandable representation from the old weights, because the neural network is just set of weights on each of the layer of the network. So this is a problem. And in this case, the neurofuzzy can facilitate basically data analysis, and it can be used for many things that I will show later on. So this is the two stages approach. The first one, when the data basically fed into the self-organizing map. The self-organizing map is a grouping algorithm that groups together the basically data samples that are similar. So afterwards, the fuzzy patches are constructed. So fuzzy patches basically represent similar group of data points in the space. So it's kind of, you can imagine like n-dimensional hyperellipsoid that covers all these data. So there are a lot of these hyperellipsoids, and together they form the fuzzy rules. So basically, fuzzy rule is a representation of this hyperellipsoid n-dimensional, depending on the number of features. The problem with neurofuzzy that we found that it produces too many rules if the data are too big, so like large scale data, and it makes problem, because for example, if the data is mistaken, there are lots of dependencies in the data. It can create just overfitted model, meaning that even though you have a lot of rules, the classification of this model in the end is just like low. And of course, you cannot like even list like thousands of these rules to go through all of them. So it's quite a problem. So this is just overview of key improvements that we've been working last 4 years. So we've been working on the parameterization of the self-organizing map, because this is the point where it influences all the model and also the complexity of the model. So it has to be done also with some consideration regarding the number of rules that you need to extract. Then we worked on the cluster compactness, or basically how this n-dimensional hyperellipsoid or fuzzy patch is constructed. Because in the original method from Costco, there was some like pseudo-radius alpha that defines the radius of this ellipsoid, and there was no mentioning how this should be done. So basically, this was another point that we worked on, and also corresponding the membership function. So basically, how the data in this ellipsoid mapped to the linguistic fuzzy sets. And also we've worked on the multinomial classification to see whether this method can be used for classifying multiple classes, not just like benign malicious, for example, but also several of those. The first thing, it was about limiting amount of rules. So we did study how this can be done based on the, let's say, randomness of the data into the in the ellipsoid. So, for example, if you have a lot of data, whether there is a correlation or these data are totally random. So if they are more random, then probably you need to use like one general cluster. If they have more like dependency, and if it, even if it's not linear or something, then you need to use more more specific clusters to cover this, to have a better coverage and avoid these errors in the model. So basically, this is how it looks like. The assumption was that the data are normally distributed, because after looking in the data that into data sets that we had, apparently most of the data in those data sets were quite close to normal distribution. So in this case, it makes sense to have this hyper ellipsoid instead of the rectangular patch. So you can see that this is rectangular patch and this is elliptic fuzzy patch. So it means that you have more errors or some kind of like mistake in the model. And this is when you have more random data distribution inside the cluster. And there you have like little bit more correlation. So in this case, it makes sense to have couple more and more specific fuzzy patches. The next thing was about the estimation of the fuzzy patches. So how can we basically find the pseudo radius in this hyper ellipsoid that was proposed by Koska, but there were no explanation how it should be done. So apparently this can be done using the chi-square test. So when the data, so this is basically data fitting test, whether this ellipsoid can be used to describe the data in this area, and what are the confidence interval. So it's probably some of you know the statistics, the chi-square test or test of goodness of fit. It's used like to understand whether the data fitted into the model. There is a confidence interval to which extent, for example, 95%, 90%, it should be into this hyper ellipsoid. And also degrees of freedom. So degrees of freedom in that case from contingency table describes how many parameters that we can basically tune in the model. And the last thing was the Gaussian membership function. So you can see here that this is the original model that uses, this is the membership function. So this is just triangular projection. It's quite simple. What Koska did was just to inscribe some kind of big rectangle around this hyper ellipsoid and use the projection base. But in this case, it does not count whether it's rotated, whether it's long, short, or any kind of information. So what we proposed is to extract these parameters from the estimated before hyper ellipsoid and then use it as a Gaussian membership function parameters. So this is basically the comparison between the improvements. Just examples, like you have two fuzzy patches, and then you have two also here, two fuzzy patches. They also can be overlapping, because this is the point of like using fuzzy logic. Some of the application and use cases. So the first case is firewall rules generation, because I guess some of you work with firewalls, and you know that you need a lot of rules to protect against different types of misuse in the network, against different types of attacks. And one of the problems that can be is that sometimes it's just a human factor. There are mistakes in those rules causing some kind of attacks happening quite successfully. So in this case, the scenario would be if you use a lot of data, sufficiently enough data for building the model, you train the neurofuzzy model, and then you produce the fuzzy rules. So not only having the alert that this has happened, but also the kind of explanation why this happened. Just like some of the results, we use this data set is outdated, but this is nice representation of the network traffic. So just for demonstration, we use this data set, and the difference you can see here, you have like 10,000 of rules producing 98 plus accuracy on the model. And then we have the proposed improvements together with Bootstrap aggregation, which result in like 39 rules and nearly the same accuracy. So you see that it makes sense to have this kind of improvements because the model become not that complicated. Plus another thing is that this is the amount of seconds used to learn the model, to train the model. So it can be done quite faster. Plus the inference time. So the inference time is that basically when you send, for example, this is network traffic packet, you give it to the model and you need the answer, whether it's like malicious or benign. So this is the time required to answer. So you can see also that this time reduced. We wrote a journal on the network forensics readiness, and there were some consideration how this can be used in the network in comparison to the network speed. So you can find this article and you can see that apparently it can be used to some extent, or there has to be some kind of advanced optimization like parallel optimization and so on. So all the comparison and the numbers you can find there. Another use case is malware. So this is just for illustration purpose. You can see that user can be infected in a number of different ways, like, for example, getting a file from the internet, installing it, then you have the malware infection, and then you have the sensitive data or whatever sending like to outside parties or some other malicious activities that you probably learn about. So it's a lot of things that can be done. And the point that you have these commonly used signature-based solutions like that are used in antiviruses. And the thing is that you have the benign or malicious. So it's not that, let's say, complicated to differentiate in some cases. For example, you can build a linear classifier just using a couple of features, saying like the size of the file, I don't know, the number of API calls, something like this. And then you can differentiate this between the malicious and benign file. So this is fine. So it's not that complicated. Plus also you can use MD5 hash sum, for example. It's, well, this is done. And also in the academia, you have a lot of research done on the malicious and benign. So just only two classes. What we looked for is multinomial classification. So not just benign malicious, but also what kind of malicious. So this is a little bit non-trivial problem. It wasn't explored extensively in the literature before. And what we also found that among the machine learning methods, there are a lot of methods that are originally binary, like, for example, support vector machine. You have like linear separable hyperplane that builds class 1 and, for example, class 2. So this is quite trivial. And then you have the standard neural network, which is like 0-1, for example. It's also binary. There are some classifiers that were designed as multinomial, so to handle multi-class problem. And also some of the methods, they can be tuned or they can be modified to handle these problems. So we worked together on the Windows malware analysis. So basically, this was the portable executable format. So I'm not sure how many of you know about this format. This is common format for Windows. It's for executable files, for DLL files, and so on. So it has a standard header, P32-bit header, and then you have different fields that it's hundreds of fields that you can find there. And then we also looked on the naming of malware. So what kind of things exist that can be used to label different malware samples from different families, for example. And apparently there was a meeting in the 90s, and they established this computer antivirus research organization. So they use this as a template, standard template for naming the viruses. You have the type of the virus, then you have the platform, like Windows, Linux, for example. And then you have the family, and then other information that is added afterwards. So the types, they are mostly manually assigned, but the family names, they can be manually assigned, or they can be machine-generated names. So virtually, you can have a lot of family names. And then we looked at the reports. So the biggest collection of the antivirus reports is VirusShare, VirusTotal. So basically, if you have the virus, you can see maybe, I think it's now like more than 60 antivirus databases that that are present there. And then from this, you can see that, for example, Microsoft follows the current naming scheme, and none of the other antiviruses follow the same scheme. And the problem that they all use own format, and sometimes like this format changes over time. So it's like no way that you can do it. You can write some regular expression to analyze this, or you can, I don't know, do some manual analysis, but it's just unreliable. So you cannot say whether it's true or not. So for this purpose, we use only Microsoft report from VirusTotal. There have been a collection of 400,000 Windows binaries, malware. So those are that are labeled as malware. So after analysis of the VirusTotal reports plus the PFrame reports, we found that, well, there are 328,000 of malwares that were labeled as malicious. Also, we were able to extract the families, the types. This is statistics of the families, so number of, yeah, basically number of samples per family and number per type. And this is number of samples per family. So just, you also can find this in the papers. And just if you're interested, you can visit the VirusTotal to check what the API they have, because you can retrieve any kind of data from there, and also have a look at the PE frame. So this is portable executable frame, a tool, a Python tool that is available for free. You can extract a lot of things in the more or less manageable format. Right, so this is just example of the statistics from malware families and malware types. So you can see here is like just amount of samples per family in the database. To limit little bit the scope, we also generated couple subsets, just having like 10, 100, 500 families for this purpose. And then we also use the different feature selection methods and machine learning methods and so on. So the first set of experiments was done using the static analysis, so basically static features, what kind of features you can find in the portable executable, in the PE frame report. So this is from PE header, the information from PE header that you can find, and also from VirusTotal, and some publicly available tools in Linux like strings, file command, and so on. So this was more like feasibility study, because this wasn't done before. We did a lot of experiments, and we found that, for example, surprisingly, the SVM works well on the 10 classes. So like multi-class SVM, you have the implementation like in Veka, for example. But it just fails to produce any kind of results after like having 10 families, 100 families, for example, or 500 families or more. The same happens for random forests, because the model becomes so complicated that you have like virtually up to a million of rules describing this data, like, I don't know, 500 families only. So it just no way you can use this model, and that's why the software just failed in producing the result. And some of the methods, they have like only 3% accuracy. Then we also worked on the dynamic analysis. So for the dynamic analysis, you need to execute malware to see what's happening, what are the traces. You can have the traces onto the disk, you have the traces into network traffic, you have the traces in the memory. So these can be considered as forensic traces. So we did the execution of the malware files. Then this was pushed to the machine learning algorithm, and we just did a feasibility study to see how well this works. This is example of the features, and these are tools that were used. So this is open source, free tools that you can basically download and try to play. So we had a lot of different features related to disks, and then registry, and then the network traffic. So it's a lot of things that you can extract from Windows, for example, when you run a software. You probably know the deep learning, because it's a buzzword now, and like a lot of people work with deep learning. So we tried also to see how well the deep learning can handle this non-trivial problem. And what was interesting, that you can see the increase in the accuracy, for example, for 10 layers. So this is number of layers, this is accuracy, this is time, and this is logarithmic scale, of course. So when we increase the number of layers, at some point, the deep neural network produces quite good results, up to like 70%, for example, yeah? But after some time, like when we approach thousands of or tens of thousands of layers in the deep neural network, the accuracy just end up at 10%. So meaning that probably there is error aggregation, or the model is too complex to handle this data. So artifacts, some of the technical artifacts that we found during the study, just examples of the malware and what they create. So this is the disk artifact. So we had a malware that creates a set of files in the system directories, and then this was used to attach to some of the processes. So basically, they do a lot of things that you can find in the log file. So it's really interesting and fascinating to see the logic, just to follow all of the steps that malware is trying to see. So this is, you're not looking inside the malware, you're looking at the what are the things produced. So you, just observations. And the next thing is the registry, because the registry is the set of settings in Windows. So you can have settings for your local machine, for user, for example, for system, and so on. And what was interesting, that sometimes they used to write these settings or to modify settings that are relevant to network, for example, traffic, changing the proxy settings or changing the zones settings, which is not normally used like for programs when they're getting installed. The next thing is Trojan downloader. You can see that it's getting some file which is surprisingly similar to the known Windows program. So you can see that it's trying to get this file, and like apparently it's not there, so it's getting error. The next thing is it uses, so it's a network traffic that we analyzed. It uses the get request to some external server, sending the parameters. So this is kind of like encryption or encoding. So it might take some time to understand what it is, plus the IP of the machine. So this information is sent in plain text. Anybody can read it. Sorry, and so on. The next thing, so we had the disk features, we had the network features, and we had these two types, the dynamic features, and we also had the static features. And what's interesting, that this is heat map. So heat map meaning that you have the correlation. So you can have the correlation -1, and you can have the correlation +1, for example. I think the red one is -1, and the blue one is +1. So apparently in each group of the features, you have the positive correlation. Like it's logical that the amount of files created on the disk and the size of the data that was created on the disk, they are relevant to some extent. So there is some correlation. But what was surprising, that also there are some cross-group correlation between like the network features and the disk features, and also between the static features. So it's quite interesting to see some unexpected results, like what is relevant in this case for malware. The last thing that I want to mention is another study that we did. It's about the compilation time. So when you open a file, there is a compilation time. So the time when the file was compiled by compiler. And it's quite interesting. So first assumption was we can probably use the correlation time as a reliable feature for malware detection, or at least to include it in the model. So first we did a study together, and then with Sergei, and then we collected like 16,000 of files from different versions of Windows. We just combined them together, and we tried to see the distribution of the compilation time. So here you can see the different versions of the Windows. You can see the different spikes. So probably when the Windows, this version of the Windows was released, you have more files compiled at that year, for example, and so on. So it makes sense that like before 92, there were no files compiled in this set of the benign files. Then we got the first archive, very first archive from Wireshare, and we tried to see the compilation time. And then what was interesting, that there were a lot of timestamps from like 1972, 1975, for example. So do you know what was the version of the Windows in 1972?
Or?
Yes, it wasn't even planned probably at that time. So it means that this cannot be used as a relevant feature for malware detection, but apparently there are still some dependencies, like statistically relevant dependencies, like, for example, the number of files produced, they are raising, and you can correlate it to malware campaign. So this is really exciting to see, like, you have different malware campaigns and how the number of malicious files that were compiled at that year, they are growing too. So the same was for the most recent at that time archive. So we processed it and we found that it also was growing quite significantly. So this was overview of what we did during the last years. And that's also important to use the computational intelligence. In this case, I explained how the soft computing can be used. Also, what are the improvements that we did for NeuroFuzzy to be able to handle this data, large-scale data, and so on. And then also that, surprisingly, the lower amount of rules for decision-making does not mean that the model will be with lower accuracy, for example. So it's... Yep. Thank you for your attention.
I have a question. Why do we need human understandable rules? I mean, this neural networks work so nice, but why should we care that human understand?
The problem that you have a gap in the knowledge, for example, between the, say, computer scientist, the forensics expert, and then you have a judges in the court of law. And then you need to explain it, for example, in, let's say, a couple minutes, what was the findings. So, and there can be some misunderstanding if you just show something that is too complicated to comprehend. So that's why we need to simplify somehow the representation of the data.
So we want judges and juries to understand what digital forensics analysts have been found in the lab.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Other questions? Yes? You can.
Okay. So thanks for a very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
So you had some data which you, for the example, that was the date of the compilation. And then the challenge sometimes is to check whether that data is genuine or been doctored. So maybe you want to say a couple of things about, you know, how you deal with the problem of potentially doctored data.
I mean, it's quite hard to say whether this date is actual compilation date, because you can put virtually like anything. So this cannot be considered as like truly genuine thing. So, you know, it's like probably for files that are produced together with like legitimate software, you can say that this is true date. But for malware, it's like you need to have some other indicators, probably some things that some other dates that are present in the file, for example.
Comment, the analysis, forensic analysis of timestamps is a completely different research or field of expertise and research. And the analysis of timestamps, how to detect change timestamps, it's out of scope for this research. So it was more to identify, can we trust timestamps? No, we clearly prove timestamps cannot be trusted. This was to exclude this as a feature for malware. So, and for timestamps, we invite other experts. Other questions? I have 2 cups, so, and I can give away 2 cups for the 2 best questions. Yes.
It's not a question, it's more of a comment. I think your research topic seems really interesting. I didn't
Thank
understand
you.
Much of it, but it does really seem like you've done some good work, and I congratulate you when you get your PhD thesis approved.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You want a cup?
Okay, since you are almost done, if you have to put one, what would be the most significant finding that you had in these 4 years?
The most significant?
It can be anything. It
can be anything. I think that this is one of the major key findings, because like it was a surprise. So maybe on small case scenario you cannot see it, but like on large case scenario with a lot of like files, you can really see a lot of things, especially like the correlation to the malware campaign. So I think it was interesting that you can like draw some like intelligence also to see it together.
Is this your answer?
Yes.
Can I say something? I think there are 2 aspects. Neurofuzzy as a field was out of scope because it underperformed. So when neurofuzzy was introduced in the late 90s, some people experimented with it in the beginning of 20s, but it never had a great breakthrough like random forest support vector machine or now deep learning. And we heard that neurofuzzy, as it was originally introduced, had some shortcomings. Now, with the work André has done and what he modestly puts under the table is, we are able to improve the traditional neurofuzzy algorithms. So imagine, he wanted to solve a problem in forensics. He had data from forensics. And he found out that in order to process this data from the forensic sciences and in order to satisfy the needs in a courtroom, that you may need to understand the finding because you cannot present a neural network or a support vector machine. We have to come with new algorithms. What was there, what was good enough? And he improved the machine learning method by learning from the forensic field. So computational forensics is the combination of 2 domains, and André made it work. And I think this is your main contribution. And then he had, along the way, a lot of practical experiences that deepened his understanding in malware analysis. So machine learning and forensics together. There was another question.
This is obviously pretty advanced stuff that you're dealing with. Do you have any introductory literature to the topic that you can give off the top of your head?
Like, you mean in terms of neurofuzzy or digital forensics or
in terms of digital forensics?
Digital forensics. There are some books, but I think there is also, Catherine has some publication on computational forensics, so you can read how to combine.
It depends,
like
it depends what you want. So my message, overnight success takes years. So when André came to us, he had a master's degree from Kiev, so he was very good in a principal understanding of computer science. And he was very good in math and statistics. This is the base. And then he learned 2 things in parallel. He learned machine learning and pattern recognition by taking, for instance, the courses we offer. And he took digital forensics and digital forensics 1 and 2, which is now introduction to digital forensics and cybercrime investigation, where he learned everything about malware analysis and the needs in forensic sciences. These are the introduction, and I would recommend if you want the introduction, then look at the courses. Yeah? And then we can build up. So there are very nice books, and we have now offering courses from Geir Olaf Dirkelbotten, who's obviously a colleague from you, if your shirt tells your affiliation. Geir Olaf teaches in the second semester in the master program malware analysis. So there you can learn everything about malware analysis, static analysis, and dynamic analysis. And we have sitting here Carl teaching machine learning. And then you put both together. And you spend a lot of nights in the lab. Right? So, but if you're interested, we invite everybody to join the group. And then using master topics, for instance, in cooperation with André to specialize in the field. So I have been reminded that we are running over time. Whom do we choose for the best question?
You're the chair.
I'm the chair.
Right, thank you.
Good. Goodbye, everybody online. Good. One slide on the judge.
What's here?
One slide on the judge in the beginning. Otherwise, they don't get it. Good. Very good. Thanks.